Guardian Unlimited.
Hello and welcome to another helping of the Guardian's Arts and Entertainment podcast with me, Pascal Wise. On the table this week is the Hay Literary Festival, some knobbly breasts and other delights in the Turner Prize shortlist, architecture correspondent Jonathan Glancy's critical moment, and music live in the pod from Josh Ritter. But first, now that the dust is settling after the Da Vinci Code crash-landed at the Cannes Film Festival, we thought we'd better get the latest from Zan Brooks, our online film editor, who is down the line in the south of France. Zan, how are you bearing up? Are you developing a rich and golden tan down there?
I don't think I really tan, actually, Pascal. I kind of burn, so I've got a slight red neck from kind of wandering along the Croisette in a kind of mad panic for most of the week.
So, how's the week been?
The week's been fantastic. It's been quite a kind of giddy whirl, as I think it kind of tends to be. The thing about Cannes is that it is sort of maddening and infuriating and often kind of aggressive and quite horribly disorganized at times. It somehow kind of keeps ticking along. It keeps kind of going. And there's a kind of abundance of films and abundance of people around and things like that. So it's really a kind of... You can kind of come here and have maybe kind of 1,000 different Cannes experiences, and everybody's having sort of a different take on it.
Okay, well, given all these different takes, is there a general feeling about the kind of runners and riders now? Because the prizes are now in sight, aren't they? Now the Da Vinci Code is out of the way.
Da Vinci Code is out of the way. I mean, I guess this Cannes has gone from the kind of ridiculous to the sublime, really, starting out with the Da Vinci Code and then finally getting onto the kind of main business of kind of good films in competition. We're kind of into the sort of the final straight now, and I guess the general sense is, so far, is that Pedro Almodovar is the kind of the man to beat with Volva, which has got an incredibly kind of eulogistic response. People just absolutely have kind of fallen over themselves about it. So that remains the kind of the hot favorite to take the Palme d'Or on Sunday. And yet, just last night, they had the screening of Babel, which is the new film by Alejandro González Iñárritu, who did Amores Perros and 21 Grams. And that is the kind of the surprise kind of smash of the festival, and that has kind of almost kind of thrown everything out the window. At the moment, it seems to be a kind of two-horse race between Babel and the Almodovar film Volver.
Okay, it sounds like it could be a bit of a photo finish as well.
You know, there's still films to come. There's Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette that people are kind of very intrigued to see what she's done with that.
Right. And what have you been doing in your spare time? Have you been ligging a few parties for us?
Well, this is the kind of the thing about Cannes, is that you kind of spend most of the day just running around like crazy, and then at the end there's this sort of weird drift to kind of various kind of parties or kind of drinking holes. So there's been the BBC party was the other day, the London Film Festival party was the other day, it's like people going around between different sort of oases in the desert, and so you kind of run into the same people there.
Tessa Jowell, I hear you.
Tessa Jowell was at the London Film Festival party. By a curious coincidence, just before the screening of the Nanni Moretti film The Cayman, which is actually a kind of brutal satire on Berlusconi, but I'm not sure that Tessa was here to kind of check that particular film out.
And I hear you've been had a few guests on the doorstep as well.
All human life is here, Pask. So as well as the kind of the A-list celebrities and the kind of jobbing journalists, there's also a kind of a huge sort of down-and-out populace here in Cannes. So we arrived back the other night to find two down-and-outs actually sort of camping on the landing outside our flat. And the weird thing was that they were sitting there wearing official kind of Cannes baseball caps and carrying copies of Variety magazine. And my first thought was that, they must be film journalists.
Well, keep your head on, Zan. Good luck in the final straight.
Cheers, Pat.
And you can get all the latest on the festival by going to film.guardian.co.uk. This year's Turner Prize shortlist has just been announced, the contemporary competition that has triggered plenty of "but is it art?" discussions over the years. The entrants, who have to be British artists under the age of 50, have now been whittled down to four, each competing for the £25,000 prize, which will be awarded in December. Joining me to look at the merits of those chosen few is Tom Morton, curator of the Cubic Gallery in London. Tom, I've been reading around and I'm getting phrases like humongous knobbly breasts and disco dancing marathons. Can you talk us through some of the kinds of art we're going to see here?
Humongous knobbly breasts is reasonably accurate, actually.
if we're speaking about the work of Rebecca Warren. She's a British sculptor. She makes her work in unfired clay, so it's slapping one piece of clay on another without it going into the kiln. And this is work that references a whole bunch of important male artists, usually from the 20th century. So Picasso, Robert Crumb, Helmut Newton. And these are all men who make kind of very sexualized images of women. And so the interest here really is to see a woman take those male-generated images of women and put a certain spiky spin on it.
Moving on through the list, Phil Collins, what about his work?
Phil Collins' work most famously includes a disco dancing contest he held in Ramallah for young Palestinians. It's called They Shoot Horses, Don't They, this piece, obviously based on the Elizabeth Taylor film, which involved kind of dance contests in the American Depression.
Doesn't he stages a dance for something like 48 hours, is that right? So you see a kind of gradual exhaustion.
Absolutely, absolutely, of these young Palestinians.
Okay.
And the dance is very exuberant, very energetic, and sort of broken up occasionally by a muezzin's cry or by a power cut or so on and so forth.
Next up, Thomas Abts. All these works are of a sort of specific size, aren't they?
They're absolutely. Just a little bit larger than a human head.
How would you describe the style of these works?
Well, some people describe them as abstract. I think that's slightly incorrect. I mean, perhaps non-representational is the best way of describing these. They're a very particular size. They're almost geometrical, although they're drawn freehand or painted freehand rather than with geometrical instruments.
Interesting. And then finally, the Mark Titchener works. A lot of use of words in here and graphics.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also episodes from cultural and countercultural history. He's very interested in Wilhelm Reich, for example, and has actually remade his orgone machine in a work of the past, which is a machine for inducing orgasm or collecting orgasmic energy.
How would you describe the kind of healthiness of the competition now? I mean, it's clearly been through phases and times when the kind of furore surrounding it was, you know, at risk of overshadowing some of the art. Is it still something that's getting new people into art?
Well, I mean, the Turner Prize is, by a long stretch, the most heavily visited contemporary art show in Britain of the year, year on year.
Right.
So it absolutely succeeds in that regard. Whether the idea of a prize is particularly interesting or not is an entirely different question. I mean, it seems to me very difficult to compare one artist's work to another. But this, again, is, of course, is a problem we encounter with the Booker Prize or the Mercury Prize or any other cultural prize you choose to mention.
I'm just thinking, is there a move to get away from that tricksiness now and to have the prize seen as really representative of good art as opposed to tricks?
Well, I think the idea was that it was always representative of good art. And tricksiness, of course, is in the mind of the perceiver. And I think a large amount of that perceiving was done by the press and especially the tabloid press rather than the public. You look at the disgust about the Turner Prize shortlist and a number of newspapers every year, and then you look at the visiting figures, and these two things don't quite add up.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Tom. And works by the shortlisted artists will be shown in an exhibition at Tate Britain beginning on the 3rd of October. The winner will be announced at Tate Britain on the 4th of December during a live broadcast by Channel 4. You can see galleries of the shortlisted works as well as coverage throughout the year at arts.guardian.co.uk.
The Guardian podcast, sponsored by Volvo. The all-new Volvo C70 invites you to feel, open up and see what's driving the real movers and shakers of the world.
Time now for our critical moment, our weekly look at works of art that have changed people's lives. This week we've been talking to Jonathan Glancy, The Guardian's architecture correspondent, about his Eureka moment. He told Andrew Dixon what it was like to see Norman Foster's Sainsbury's Centre in Norwich for the first time.
I first saw the Sainsbury's Centre in the pages of the Architecture Review. Now, the Review was the grandest, most wonderful architectural magazine possibly in the world at that time, 1978. That was the point where I was between school and college. I thought of being an architect, but I found architecture schools too pretentious, I'm afraid. But I saw this building in the magazine and I was totally thrilled. Here was a building that wasn't conventionally modern in the sense of the high-rise horrors of the 60s and 70s. It wasn't made of concrete with dampness around it and wasn't grim in any way. It wasn't something the national press could have said, the ugly horror blighting the country. It was a gleaming, shining building that was like an ultra-modern aircraft hangar sitting on a green lawn at the centre of the University of East Anglia. It was a modern dream. And so you'd seen all those articles and you were off to go and see the real thing. Once I saw the Sainsbury Centre in the magazine, I was off on my cheap day return to Norwich from Liverpool Street and the bus ride up to the University of East Anglia. And the building didn't disappoint at all. It was new, it did gleam, it was like a great silver machine. And in a funny way, it was a kind of ultra-modern Greek temple too, if that doesn't sound crazy. That's what it was. It was like a Parthenon of our times. That's really what it is. It's like a home for the muses, you know, for the arts, for the sort of goddess of learning, if you like, for today. A building in a funny way, ultra-modern, and yet threading right back through history. Now, the architecture dictionary I was looking in said that this building is high-tech modern. It's 25 years old this year. Is it still modern, do you think?
The Sainsbury Centre certainly still is modern. What makes it modern? It's a building that says, I am about progress. A lot of modern movement buildings, big concrete hulks, look ancient today because they've weathered very badly, and they're quite clunky things. Clunky when they're built in the 50s or 60s, and even clunkier today. The Sainsbury Centre has just been renovated completely, a quarter of a century on. It reopens this month, May, and it looks as modern now as it did 25 years ago.
Foster once said that his favourite building was the Boeing 747. I mean, is that kind of connection between engineering and aeronautics, that whole line of architecture, that's, Foster is very much part of that, isn't he? That high-tech way of doing things.
Foster is our Lord High-Tech. He is the greatest high-tech architect in the world. That is how he made his name, doing something totally different. The man absolutely adores engineering. He is a pilot, and most of all, he loves flight. He fly a helicopter, he can fly his own jet plane, he used to do a lot of aerobatics, I'm absolutely in love with it. But that, of course, is very interesting. It creates a very English modernism, that love of engineering. Now, Britain was the country, the iron cradle, as it were, of the Industrial Revolution, and that tradition of making things beautifully, of research and engineering, comes into a very particular English architecture that burst out remarkably late in the 1970s. It's to do with a meeting of engineering know-how, a love of engineering, and try to create a building that looks like it spells out progress in big letters.
And is it Foster's best building, do you think?
I think it still is Foster's best building. It's because it's so pure as a concept and because it works. You walk in there still and the interior is still gloriously light. And it's not delicate, it has a filigree quality of light, a magical quality of light. Outside it, it's still this glorious, enigmatic machine. And the thing is, it just is not part of that barren, crude, ugly, brutal modern tradition that was the one that develops in Britain when the British architects were trying to ape the intellectual Europeans and got it all wrong. Foster, terribly English architect, never been anything other than English architect, and that's where his strength comes.
Jonathan Glancy talking to Andrew Dixon about Norman Foster's Sainsbury's Centre at UEA in Norwich. And you can see what the fuss is about for yourself as the refurbished building reopens at the end of May. On Friday, thousands of bookworms will be descending on a small town in Herefordshire for the 19th Hay Literary Festival. It's the perfect place, really, since it has around 1,500 people living there, but a staggering 41 bookshops. I'm joined by Sarah Crown, Guardian Unlimited's books editor, and John Mullen, Professor of English at University College London. Sarah, literary festival, it's one of those phrases, I find it rather daunting. It's sort of a very studious impression, and lots of linen suits and scratching of chins. I mean, maybe that's just me, but this is actually quite a multimedia varied event, isn't it?
Well, as ever, there's loads of great stuff going on. The theme of this year's festival is climate change, and it's a lot of the sponsors are sort of environmentally friendly, ethical sponsors. They've got Triodos Bank, I think. And
this is what Al Gore is.
Yes, well, he is the starter in this year, definitely, the former US Vice President. He's going to be speaking on Monday the 29th at 7 o'clock about what he's describing as the planetary emergency of global warming, and that's sure to be sold out, I should think. From a more booksy point of view, we've got Seamus Heaney, who's one of the, if not the, greatest poet alive and writing today, who's talking to Peter Florence, the festival director, about District and Circle, which is his latest collection. And I actually saw him at the South Bank Centre giving this talk about a month and a half ago, and he was wonderful. It's a real treat to hear him speak. You've also got Sarah Waters talking about The Night Watch, her latest novel, which, if you haven't read it yet, is absolutely brilliant. Very good chance of winning the Orange Prize on June the 6th, and probably a shoo-in for this year's Booker shortlist if you want to put any money on that. So those two are probably the highlights for me, but you're just sport for choice, really. There's Margaret Atwood, DBC Pierre, Zadie Smith, Jeanette Winterson, David Hare, and the Children's Festival as well.
Of course, yeah. You mentioned Seamus Heaney there. Mm. Poetry, there seems to be a strong poetry lineup.
All poetry events are very well attended at Hay. They also have a Fringe Festival now, which has been running for about 2 years, which is focused around the Poetry Bookshop, which is a beautiful bookshop in the town centre.
A real smorgasbord there. Mm. John, turning to you, you're going to be working at the festival this year, talking there. Tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing.
Well, I'm going to be talking at a very, very early hour in the morning, 2 days in a row. And because it's such an early hour, I'm going to be talking about Jane Austen and Charles Dickens in the hope that even though it's early, I might attract a few people in cagoules who've got lost on their way to Monty Don. 9 o'clock, which is quite early for literary discussion. But there's some very, very keen people go to Hay on Wye, and I think even at that early hour, they might want to hear about some great books. I don't know. Fingers crossed.
Well, let's hope so. You've been a few times in the past few years. Do you have some favourite anecdotes from your experiences?
I've had some wonderful experiences in Hay on Wye. I mean, the great thing is that it's a pleasant occasion. People are very nice. And as a sort of slightly as a descant to what Sarah was talking about, all the things that she says as highlights of this year's festival are indeed highlights. But I always rather look forward to the things which perhaps aren't quite so sort of pleasant and interesting. There are a few, the people it's worth going to are always the ones who are going to be slightly sort of grumpy and irascible and slightly out of the spirit of the festival. So I'd always advocate, for instance, going to Christopher Hitchens, who's one of the few people who actually openly has rows with members of the audience.
He's a regular, isn't he?
Brilliant, yeah. One about smoking last year, I seem to remember, where one of the people in his talk objected to him chain smoking underneath a no smoking sign. And they were supposed to be talking about politics. They had a brilliant sort of quarter of an hour long debate about the morality of obeying signs and smoking. It was wonderful, one of those moments where it comes alive. I think the memory I treasure of Hay on Wye was one of those things which will never be replicated, where somebody was giving a talk and mentioned something which if you weren't there to hear it, you wouldn't believe it, which was Uri Geller, I remember, discussing his relationship with current events, and it was just after the Euro 96 football tournament, and to the silent amazement of everybody in the tent, he asked us if we had or hadn't seen on the television replays the ball move slightly before Gary McAllister took the penalty, which I'm sure everybody here remembers he missed for Scotland against England. You remember, it's a turning point. He missed a penalty, and a minute later Gazza scored and England were through, and on the close-ups the ball did move slightly, and Uri Geller openly and earnestly claimed in the tent at Hay that he had been actually up in a helicopter during the match and had moved the ball, and then said with a kind of aplomb, really, "And I'm very sorry to all the Scottish people here, but you are my friends too." I was fantastic. And those are the kind of moments I think Hay is, to be treasured
for. Well, if that hasn't completely destroyed my image of linen suits and fusty discussions, I don't know what will. Well, you'll be looking forward then to people standing up at 9 a.m. and arguing tooth and nail with you about...
Well, Jane Austen is one of the few things which, even despite my talking about it, people sometimes do get quite aroused about, actually. So I just hope there are a few itinerant members of the Jane Austen Society who are in Hay. I shall be, however, looking forward to some of the things which are sort of lower pleasures than what Sarah mentions. I think Princess Michael of Kent talking about courtesans and their relationship. These are the slightly surreal things.
That's definitely a hot
That
ticket.
And Roly Moe appearing 2 days in a row.
Thanks very much to John Mullen and Sarah Crown. The Hay Festival runs from this Friday and ends on June 4th. For details, go to www.hayfestival.com. And Sarah, just to catch you on the coverage for The Guardian website, you'll be there presumably for the whole festival.
Yes, we'll be up from the Friday until the Sunday evening, I think, blogging. So if you can't make it, you can at least read about it on the website. And we've got a dedicated special report at guardian.co.uk/books/hay2006. And also probably most important thing to mention is that we will be hosting a live webcast of Al Gore's event on the Monday night. So if you can't make it, can't buy a ticket, you can still hear what he has to say.
Thanks, Sarah. So what are the other arts events coming up that are looking tempting or intriguing? I'm joined by our arts editor-in-chief, Claire Margetson. Claire, what's got our critics excited this week?
Weirdly, actually, sticking with Hay for Friday night, PJ Harvey is going to be making her only UK festival appearance. And this is a fantastic chance to hear her in a quite a sort of a relatively small setting. I mean, she's someone who obviously can fill a stadium and headline a festival. So that's quite a good chance to hear her. But if you can't get there, you can hear her on the arts website, arts.guardian.co.uk. We'll be putting an exclusive track from her gig on over the weekend. And then otherwise, on Sunday, I'd recommend going down to the Opera House, where the wonderful Willard White will be reprising his role of Bluebeard. That's Willie Decker's production of Duke Bluebeard's Castle.
I still always think Barry White when anyone says Willard White. I don't know why. It's one of those little problems in my wiring. Let's make that clear. Willard White, yeah.
And then next Tuesday, that's Tuesday the 30th, the Barbican will have Masaki Suzuki and his Japanese Bath Collegium. And they will be performing the B minor Mass, Bach's B minor Mass. And that's their first UK appearance.
Yeah, this was the conductor who was rather lampooned for tackling Bach with Japanese performers, and he's quite clearly put his critics to rest on this one. I mean, it apparently is a spectacular show.
Absolutely. And then it's sort of not a great week for film, actually, probably because Cannes is on. But if you want to go to the cinema, I think Friends with Money, which is a bit of a girly number for female friends in LA and their relationships with men. And that stars Jennifer Aniston and apparently a rather fantastic Frances McDormand. But lastly, you should really think about booking for Evita if you have any taste for musicals. This is its first appearance in the West End for 20 years. And the thing that makes it interesting is they've got Michael Grandage, he of the Donmar, who is sort of, you know, normally thought of as quite a sort of serious, texty director. But he brought Guys and Dolls to West End with Ewan McGregor, which he's done fantastically. Yeah. So that should be quite interesting. You know, banish all thoughts of Madonna.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, wrestling it from Madge.
And, absolutely. Yeah. No, Madge is out. And the Argentinian unknown Elena Roger, probably completely mispronounced there. She'll be taking the part.
Thanks very much, Claire.
Further insight can be found behind the wheel of the new Volvo C70. Visit www.volvocars.co.uk.
He thought he was going to be a neuroscientist, but 2 years into his biology course at university, Josh Ritter realised that he was heading off in the wrong direction. Remembering the inspiration of hearing Bob Dylan as a teenager, Ritter became a singer-songwriter, quickly earning comparisons to Dylan and Leonard Cohen. Now on his third album, he's been over in the UK this week to talk about it. He spoke to our film and music editor, Michael Hahn, about what it's like being a patriotic American in troubled times.
It's such an interesting time everywhere, because I think there's the level of conflicted opinions in the States is huge. And I know that as it is here, you know, we're in a real time of transition. I think not just America, but like the Western Hemisphere. Everything is kind of up in the air. And Mark Twain was a big part of the writing of this record for me. He's a guy who is a social commentator. His love of the country was so unimpeachable, because you could tell he loved it, but he held it to account. And he said this amazing thing. He said, loyalty to your country always, loyalty to your government when it deserves it. And so that's the kind of attitude I go into these shows with. You know, I'm not out there to preach and tell people what to think or to defend my country or to defend a government or to go the other direction and say, you know, these are great people that we have, you know, elected. I just sort of think that it's better to go in and put a whole bunch of images out there and not give people the captions, you know, not editorialize, because I hear too much of that in music right now, you know, and I think it robs it the poetry from songs.
Now, it's interesting you make reference to Mark Twain there. reading your lyrics, they come across almost as poems. Yeah, I have a friend with whom I kind of swap song lyrics randomly at boring points in the day. I usually just end up sending Roadrunner by the Modern Lovers because I love it so much. But they've sent back several of your lyrics, and reading them, just written down in print, they do come across as poems. I mean, do you find yourself inspired as much by literature as by music?
Definitely. I think that I always think it's funny that people always ask, you know, who are your influences, and they assume that they're always just musical. And I there's of course lots of great musicians that I have gotten influenced by, but I read far more than I listen to a lot of music, and Muriel Spark is a huge one for me, and Roughing It by Mark Twain and Philip Roth, you know, the poet John Burnside from Scotland. There's just some incredible writing out there, and the world is wide open. I mean, there's just more than relationship songs, you know, and it's exciting to go at it with the idea that you can be influenced by more than Neil Young.
Well, with that, I hope that you'll perform a song for us here. Well, yeah. What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to play you a relationship song influenced by Neil Young. No, this is a song called Good Man, and I wrote it when I was down south of where I'm from. I'm from Moscow, Idaho, and there's a town called Lewiston, and it's in a place called Hell's Canyon. It's the deepest canyon in the northern hemisphere, and it's a beautiful place. Chords are old, but we shake hands. I believe that they're the good guys, and we can use all the help we can. So many minor chords outside, I fell in love with the sound. Oh, I love to sing along with you. We got tunes we kicked around, song. We got a bucket that the tunes go through. Babe, we both had dry spells, hard times, and bad lands. I'm a good man for you. I'm a good man. Last night there was a horse in the road. I was twisted in the hairpins. My hands held on, my mind let go. Back to you, my heart went skipping. I found the inside of the road. I thought about the first time that I met you, and all those glances that we stole. Sometimes, if you want them, then you got to. Babe, we both had dry spells, hard times, and bad lands. I'm a good man for you. I'm a good man. Shot a western south of here. They had him cornered in a canyon, and even his horse had disappeared. They said he got run down by a bad, bad man. You're not a good shot, but I'm worse. There's so much where we ain't been. Yeah, swing up on this little horse. The only thing we'll hit is sunset. Babe, we both had dry spells, hard times, and bad lands. I'm a good man for ya. I'm a good man. Babe, we both had. You and I both had. Babe, we
both had. You and I both had. Baby, both. Baby, both had. Baby, both had. Dry spells, hard times, bad lands. I'm a good man for ya. I'm a good man.
Josh Ritter, thank you ever so much.
Thank you very much.
Josh Ritter playing us out there. His third album, The Animal Years, is out now. That's all we have time for this week. Thanks to my guests, John Mullen, Sarah Crown, Tom Morton and Claire Margitson. Do let us know what you think by emailing podcasts@guardian.co.uk or posting a comment at blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Our producers were Natalie McDermott and Tom Lutz. I'm Pascal Wise. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.